I don't care who's first or who last, but I know that y'all just better rock this at the drop of a dime, baby. I don't know what y'all gonna do with this, but it got to be funky.
Listen closely, so your attention's undivided. Many in the past have tried to do what I did. Just the way I came off then, I'm gonna come off stronger and longer, even with the drum off. I'll keep on going and flowing just like a river. I got a whole lot to give, so I'ma give up. Little at a time, new trails are blazing. Action is in effect and always stays in. Yeah, just like a shot from a cannon, I am the man in charge and I'm planning. A jam strong enough that it can lift your soul. I'm the originator and my rhymes are made of gold. Once you hear the capital A, rap it'll stay with you for a while. It won't go away unless you force it, because it stays with you, my friend. And if you force it away, I'ma hit you again. I project my voice so it's right in the crowd. There's a sign at the door, no biting allowed. And if you didn't read it, I suggest you do so, or you'll be stranded just like Caruso. Sleep if you wanna, go ahead, get some shut-eye. A man broke his jaw trying to say what I say on the microphone. He should've left it alone, just for the record. Let it be known that my ego's only partially grown. And never would I ever condone fighting in any form. Yo, I'm only warm. That verse was the calm. Now here's the storm.
Next. Yep, yep, it's your man Jay Hicks back again with the Hip Hop Sports Report Podcast. Thank you all for listening. Today would be Sunday, October the 4th. Thank you for joining us on this beautiful Sunday morning in 2015. We have a very special podcast this morning. Now, I say that often, and I believe all my podcasts are special. I really do. All the Hip Hop Sportswear podcasts are special. But this one is, we're taking it up a notch this morning. And I'll do that after I do, you know, the brief intro. You guys know the deal. Just wanted to shout out the website, of course, hiphopsportsreport.com. Please go ahead and follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/HHS Report, facebook.com/HHS Report. We're on a social media thing. Of course, hit up the podcast on iTunes. So do a search on iTunes, look for the podcast, hit us up, and definitely we will be there in your ear holes with all that realness when it comes to hip hop and sports. And again, we're also available on Stitcher Radio. Be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast, y'all. Thank you. I don't want to get too bogged down with that stuff. But one other thing I did want to mention was, again, and I've mentioned it on the podcast before, y'all, but if you guys are really into hip hop, but you also are into reading and literature, you know, it's getting a little chilly outside. You know what I'm saying? It may be time to find some good reading material for the winter. Please go to obeliskmediagroup.com. That's OBELISK.com. And hit up Natural Life, a book by Kenneth Hicks. That is a phenomenal book that kind of infuses hip-hop into the story there. So please go ahead and check out Natural Life. It's also it's available on Amazon.com and ObeliskMediaGroup.com. Now, we have hip-hop royalty on the podcast this morning. And so this is why I'm so excited, y'all. Hip-hop royalty is in the building. This gentleman has almost a 30-year rap career, man. 30 years. Think about how many MCs that are just fly-by-night, flash in the pans, you know what I mean? These Johnny-come-latelys, they come in and then they're gone before you even remember what their name was. This guy's been in the game for nearly 3 decades. He's been on some of the most memorable hip-hop joints, hip-hop tracks, records of all time, and he's inspired some of the greatest artists that we've ever heard. Straight out of Brooklyn, y'all. Please give it up for Mr. Master Ace. Ace, how you feeling this morning?
What's going on, Jay Hicks? How you doing?
I'm chilling, man, and I'm ecstatic that you're on the podcast today. Like I said, I'm really happy that we were able to make this happen. And I really don't want to get into too much of an introduction, man, because I really want to just jump into the questions, because there's so much to ask somebody who has such a unique perspective on the game as you do. I guess there's really no better place to start than from the beginning. A lot of people know you from the record The Symphony, which is one of the all-time great posse cuts ever. It basically birthed the posse cut, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was included the entire Juice crew, yourself. It was a Marley Marl record, of course, but you know, you were on it. Craig G, Big Daddy Kane, Cool G Rap. It was just a legendary record. And I've heard you tell the story of how you kind of got onto that song. You know, basically, if I understand it correctly, MC Shan was supposed to be on the record, but he kind of basically curved y'all to a degree anyway, and kind of bounced and because he was real big time at the moment. So you kind of the crew was all together about to record, and nobody kind of wanted to get on the mic and warm the mic up. So you kind of stepped up to the plate and kind of took that responsibility on, and next thing you know, history is made. But what I was wondering was, how did your life change when that record came out? Like, because I don't even know if you knew they were going to keep the verse initially, but once they decided to do that and then the record just blew up, how did that change your life?
Well, one of my strongest memories is when the record first got played on the radio in New York City, and as soon as the record started playing, my phone started ringing off the hook. Like, this is way before cell phones, so you just imagine my house phone just, it would ring, I would pick it up, yo, it's dope, right? Yeah, hang up, ring right again. Like, it was like back-to-back-to-back people calling the house, just saying that they were listening to the radio and hearing the song. Nothing really changed until the video came out, because it was that visual that all of a sudden introduced me to the world in a real way. Because, you know, when I walked into that saloon, that dusty, you know, saloon, my name, you know, came across the bottom of the screen, introducing me to the world. And from that moment, I became part of the music industry, and I've been employed in the music business since that moment.
One thing I've always wondered, though, was the fact that, like, the Juice Crew, everybody was from Queens for the most part, and you were from Brooklyn. Like, so I know it was kind of random how y'all got together, because I think it was, like, I think you had won a rap contest, right? And then you kind of got some studio time with Marley Marl, but most of those cats is from Queens, and you were from Brooklyn. Was there any type of weirdness between that, or any animosity? Were they cracking jokes on you, anything like that?
Nah, there was no animosity, no weirdness. I wasn't actually the first Brooklyn cat. Kane was. Big Daddy Kane was from Brooklyn. And Bismarck E wasn't from Queens either. He kind of grew up in Brooklyn, Long Island, Jersey. So he wasn't a Queens dude either. And so, you know, in a real way, the bigger names, which was Kane and Biz, weren't from Queens. Marley, of course, was from Queens. Shan, Craig G, Roxanne Shanté. But it was never an issue about, like, where somebody was from or whatever. I mean, at least nothing that I saw or felt. It was pretty much everybody was, like, you know, it was all love for the most part.
Again, with all y'all coming together on that record, like, you let off the record. And when I think back to Legendary Posse Cuts, like, immediately records like the Triumph Wu-Tang record comes to mind. And when Inspector Deck had the first verse and he just murdered the mic, Flavor in the Ear remix with Big, the International Players Anthem, Andre 3000, Scenario with Fife Diggy coming out the gate. Like, do you feel that there's any type of responsibility that the guy who leads off first, does that person need to come the hardest in order for it to be, for it to not be whack? Or can you have a dope posse cut if the guy who's the first to step up to the microphone doesn't take care of business?
The interesting thing about that is, at the time when we recorded that song, it actually wasn't a favorable thing to go first. Nobody ever wanted to. Everybody always wanted to back clean up, if you will, or you know, be the anchor leg. It wasn't until the Symphony record that artists started to say, well, first is actually a better spot, because I know if they play the record, my verse is going to get played. Because what happens is, on these posse cuts sometimes, especially on the radio, you know, a lot of times they don't get to that last verse because they got to go into another song, or DJs don't let it play long enough. So I was kind of like leading the way in terms of the first spot being the more beneficial spot. And yeah, there was definitely a responsibility, but you started to see more artists wanting to go first on posse cuts as opposed to going last.
Right. And I feel like you still see, typically, like, whoever's song it is, like, if the song belongs to one individual, typically you see that individual go last. But I think it is something dope about having, being the first one to step up. And like you said, if you're in the club or whatever, you know, DJs, they like to play one verse and then cut the record off or whatever, but you are always going to get played. That's very true. Are there any posse cuts that you've heard in recent years that you think maybe stack up to the symphony, or is there anything that catches your ear when you think back to how it was in that era?
I don't know that in recent times that you really get the same kind of records, the posse cuts, but I feel like, you know, you mentioned Scenario. I think that was like a great record. Definitely Protect Your Neck, Wu-Tang Clan. Even though at the time we didn't view it as a posse cut because we didn't know that they were going to be individual solo artists. It was. We thought it was just a group. You know what I mean? It wasn't until sort of the solo careers happened after, so it's a little bit different. But when you're talking about solo artists sort of coming together to be on one song, you know, the Flavor in Your Ear remix, you mentioned that one. That was a great one as well. But in terms of like recent, you know, this millennium, man, it's a little more difficult to locate a record that, you know, that measures up.
I think the one that's kind of recent that stands out to me anyway is Fucking Problems, the ASAP Rocky joint that he had off his first album, and Kendrick was on there, and I think that's the one that stands out to me.
2 Chainz on that record, yeah.
And you kind of pointed this out. I'm thinking, like, this is what blows my mind about hip-hop. Like, hip-hop, there's always been collaborations and stuff like that have kind of made hip-hop what it is. These days, you're seeing less and less of that. Like, you have, even like 15 years ago, you had all these different crews, and either they were crews or they were all label mates, or they were actual groups. But, you know, you had Lox, and you had G-Unit, and you had Dipset, and you had Rockefeller, and you had all these, you know, D12, and like all these groups, or St. Lunatics, like everybody like had their little crew or whatever, and like that has kind of gone by the wayside in recent years, with the exception maybe of like ASAP Mob, and like even groups like Odd Future, they turn around and break up, and I mean obviously, you know, EMC still doing their thing, but why is it that we're not seeing as many groups doing their thing like they were even 10 or 15 years ago?
Honestly, it comes down to ego and money. A lot of times when these collectives come together, they're not initially friends. They might, you know each other or be cool with each other, but they're not, you know, really friends. And so as soon as money gets involved, it's very easy for bickering to start, complaining to start, jealousy. There's a lot of different things that creep into it. And that's why you never see these collectives, you know, they come out, they're hot, they get a little run. You know, they go on the award show, they say, you know, it's all about us now. And then 2 years later, it's like they don't even speak to each other. So that's that. When the money gets into it, that's what you see. Because the friendship was never really there.
It almost reminds you of like a championship sports team. You know what I'm saying? Like how you have a team like any team, really. Like any team that wins the title maybe the first year or something like that. And then everybody gets an ego. Everybody wants a shoe deal. Everybody wants endorsement dollars. Everybody wants a new contract. Then you got guys holding out. Then you got guys, you know what I'm saying, bickering for playing time, and they don't like their role. It's the same thing, it sounds like.
Yeah, it sounds like the Seattle Seahawks, really. You know, guys start leaving because they want to get, they think they feel like they have more value. You got guys holding out because they feel like they should be getting more than they're getting. And so, yeah, that's a very good comparison.
It's funny that you mentioned the Seattle Seahawks, because I actually had them as a fall off candidate in our preseason NFL preview. I had them winning the division, actually, but I had the Cardinals right there with them, and I didn't have Seattle going back to the Super Bowl for the very reasons that you just outlined, with the holdouts and with the ego when people are running their mouth more. And it's hard to keep guys hungry, man. When you get to the mountaintop, it's hard to stay hungry. And going back to the group thing, like, obviously, so you went ahead after the Juice Crew kind of branched out individually and you kind of put out a couple of solo records on your own, you ended up starting Master Ace Inc. rather. And that was a group that consisted of yourself, Lord Digga, you know, and there were some singers in the group as well, like some R&B singers, females, and then like, yeah, Lachey, exactly. That's your wife, right? Yeah, absolutely. And so then, like, you fast forward to, 10 years or whatever, and then you got, like, Murder, Inc. come out, right? And they're kind of the same thing. They got some rappers, and then they got Ashanti, the singer, on that. And then you guys put out the Slaughterhouse record in the early 90s, like 93, I think that was. And you were kind of coming with some real street stuff on that one. And then years later, we got the group Slaughterhouse. So do you feel like that they was biting you at all? Like, you're coming up with these ideas and these concepts, and then, like, years later, we're saying stuff that's, like, really similar. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know if biting is the right word. I think it's more of them looking at the projects and saying, well, that didn't sell a million, so we can probably just, you know, use that because it didn't really blow up like that. Like, if my Slaughterhouse album had sold, you know, 2 million copies, then they may have come up with another. They may have not thought that would be a good name to come up with, you know. And the same thing with Murder, Inc. You know, they started, I mean, Murder, Inc. is Murder, Inc., but then they started calling themselves the INC.
Right.
And, it's no coincidence that, you know, back when I was traveling with that name, you know, I was actually on the road doing promotional stops with Mike Geronimo. Mike Geronimo's road manager, Irv Gotti.
Wow.
No coincidence.
Wow. And there was still no, like, no part of you was just, like, a little bit like, man, like, they really just kind of swagger jacked around with it. Like, no part of you felt that way?
I mean, yeah, definitely a part of me was like, that's corny, but, and you know, I didn't like the fact that there was almost, they were almost pretending that it didn't exist before them, but it's not something to me. It's even cornier to now go public and start ranting and raving about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, these dudes, that's even cornier. So, you know, I threw a few little lines in a couple of songs just to kind of like make my core fans, you know what time that I know what time it is. But as far as, like, you know, going off and saying that's cool, I mean, and look what happened. Like, where is the new INC now? Like, you know what I'm saying, like, they don't even exist anymore. So it was short lived.
That's true. So it sounds like, though, had they kind of, like, reached back and maybe, like, extended the olive branch to you and showed love, like, look, like, we understand
and
that.
No olive branch. It's as though I didn't exist.
But I'm saying, if they did, would that have, like, yeah, like, would that have sat better with you, like, the whole thing, or no?
It would have definitely sat better with me. I would have had more respect for what they were trying to do. Even if they didn't even have to reach extended olive branch to me, if they had just kind of publicly said, you know, we know Master Ace, you know, had his thing, but this is our, you know, we're doing something different, but, you know, just acknowledgement of something that came before.
And now, to that point, I think it was Marley Marl that had kind of come out recently and was saying that a lot of the new school cats aren't really reaching back to the old school cats like they should be. And in fact, I think it was Macklemore that was kind of doing that, you know, with the Downtown record. I think that's what it's called. And I guess, you know, Marley Marl kind of felt like a lot of these new rappers aren't really paying homage. Are you with him on that, or do you feel like people just kind of need to focus on doing their own thing because it's hard enough to really make it and last in this industry anyway?
To be honest with you, I don't feel that they have an obligation to reach back and do anything. Like, you know, when we were doing our thing, we didn't feel an obligation. We just did what we did. There was definitely artists that came before us, you know, the Treacherous Threes, the Cold Crushes, the Grandmaster, the Furious Fives, the, you know what I'm saying, Fearless Fours. You know, these are cats that influenced us as we came up. And, you know, when we started making records, it wasn't like we was going back collaborating with the Fearless Four, the Furious Five, or the Treacherous Three. So we can't hold the newer artists, you know, to a high standard. We didn't do it like that, so why should we expect them to? I don't have a problem with the new cats doing stuff their way. I think it's a good thing if they know kind of their history and know where they come from and stuff like that. I think that's important, but I don't hold them to an obligation to big up, you know, cats that came before them and put them on records and collaborate with them unless it makes sense. It has to make sense. You know, you don't just well, I have to put an old school rapper on my song because otherwise I look like I don't respect the old school. I don't agree with that.
And I'm bouncing around a little bit now, but I mentioned Marley Marl, and I was thinking, like, was it difficult for you to kind of get production from him back in the Juice Crew days, simply because there was so many artists to satisfy back then?
I came at the perfect time, because he had kind of already finished with Biz. He had finished with Shan. I mean, they had done records already. Those records were out. The time when I went in the studio, the only other artist that was working on something was Craig G. Me and him was friends. So we would actually go up to Marley's crib together, because I had a little car or whatever. We would drive up there together. And one of us would do the night session. And then in the morning, one of us would do the morning session. And that's kind of how we used to do it. But I didn't have any, I didn't have to worry about, you know, Big Daddy Kane or any of those guys, because their records are already out.
How competitive was it back then with those guys? Like, when y'all, if y'all was all in the studio together, or even if y'all weren't physically recording together, but if y'all were, you know, making records or trying to put records out at the same time amongst the crew itself, how competitive did it ever get lyrically?
It's always competitive in your own mind, but it was never any outward competition where, you know what I'm saying, like, you were telling that artist, like, I'm gonna kill you on this record, or I'm gonna do you in. Like, it was never like that, but it was definitely creatively, everybody was always listening to what the other members were doing, and that would make you raise, you know, you listen to a G-Rap record, and you're like, man, this guy's killing it. All right, when I do this new record, I gotta step my game up and match that or surpass that if I can. And so having talented dudes around you is actually a benefit, because it forces you to raise your level. It forces you to be better than maybe you thought you could be, because you know you got to measure up. And so listening to Kane, listening to G-Rap, you know, MC Shan was a lyrical dude too. So you had to definitely keep your level on par with the talent that was around you, or look terrible.
When's the last time you spoke to those cats? Are you still keep in touch with Shan and Kane and G-Rap and Craig G?
I actually did a show. I'm in touch with Craig G regularly. I'm in touch with Big Daddy Kane regularly. I saw MC Shan. We actually had a show in Newark, New Jersey. There was an event called 24 Hours of Peace, and a few of us went to that. It was actually supposed to be like a little Juice Crew showcase. So DJ Polo, which is Coogee Rap's DJ, he helped put it together. He got MC Shan there, Roxanne Shanté, Craig G, myself, and Marley Marl. So we were all in the building at the same time, which was kind of cool. I got to see Shan. I hadn't seen Shan for a good 10 years. I hadn't seen him. So got to say what up to him. I see Polo from time to time. He comes out to a lot of the events. But I'm in touch with Craig G. Like, we text each other back and forth about sports, about different stuff. He's a big sports football fan as well as I am. So we talk about those things. And every now and then, Kane will reach out and ask me to come out to jump on stage with him at a local show or whatever's going on, if we decide to do that.
That's dope, man. That's dope. I didn't know Craig G was big in the sports thing like that, too. I might have to hit him up next, you know what I'm saying? Get him on the podcast.
He's a New York Jets fan.
Oh, so he's watching the game right now, then?
Oh, definitely.
I was watching a little bit of that before we jumped on this podcast. And they were giving Miami some work. But so fast forward a little bit. You know, like I said, you put out your two solo records in the early 90s. Then you created Master Ace Inc. And, you know, Born to Roll comes, Sitting on Chrome comes. This is like mid 90s, 94, 95. In that time range, I feel like, you know, your popularity is soaring at this point. And when you watch the visuals, obviously, of those videos, the thing that immediately comes to mind is just the West Coast influence that it looks like is there, like with the, not even just with the video, but with the sounds and stuff like that. But, you know, you got the cars and the beaches and the women in the bikinis and whatnot, and all that stuff
you know, and the sound of it kind of felt very West Coast. Was that just you trying to dabble in some different sounds at that time? Like, were you just feeling like you wanted to experiment? Because again, you're a Brooklyn cat that's super right. lyrical and making these songs and videos that sound real West Coast like. Was that something that the label was kind of nudging you to do, or was that just something like Ace just sat down and said, you know what, I want to try something different?
Well, everything started with the Born to Roll record. What happened there was, you know, I had a song called Jeep Ass N-Word, and so I was on a promotional tour, the same promotional tour I mentioned with Mike Geronimo, and I went into a record store, just looking at records, looking to buy records. I was definitely still trying to produce and stuff back then. And I come across this 99 cent bin. I find this record on a Def Jam label, and the name of the song was Knowledge Me. And as soon as I saw it, I knew what the record was, and I knew what the beat was, and I remembered that beat. And I said to myself, if I rhyme over that beat, I think that I could maybe grab the ears of some other markets. Even though it's an East Coast production, the sound of it was really a throwback to the days when Rick Rubin was killing it with the 808s and all of that. And I was already into that 808 stuff because I had a Jeep, I had a big system in it, I drove around Brooklyn playing my music as loud as possible. And so I went in the studio and I did, like you said, an experiment. I took the same lyrics from the original song and I put them to this beat just to see how it would sound. It sounded good to me, so I presented it to the label. And they were kind of like, what is, you know, why are we doing remixes to this song? Like, we're moving on to the Slaughterhouse single. Like, this song's over with. And I actually had to convince them to put this new creation, Born to Roll, on the B-side of Slaughterhouse. They eventually agreed, reluctantly. We put the single out. As soon as DJs, because back then you would mail out vinyl to DJs at radio stations. As soon as DJs got the vinyl, immediately they all turned it over and started playing the B-side, which was Born to Roll. It took off in San Francisco first. Big station out there, KMEL, started playing it. It immediately went down to San Diego, then LA, then Houston. All of a sudden, it just turned into this thing. So we all of a sudden, it's like, oh, we got to shoot a video. So now we go out and we shoot a video, and I was signed to a label in LA, which is Delicious Vinyl Records, and it was a lot easier for us to get a video done in LA. So we shot the video at the Super Show, the car show in LA. The song was about cars, so it just kind of made sense to shoot it at the car show. We just did it as a, you know, fish out of water, walking around, checking out these West Coast cars. Like, I wasn't trying to portray that I was from there or anything. I clearly showed that I was coming to visit LA and went to the car show. All of a sudden, that record started blowing up in all of these West Coast markets. And it was at that point that the label said, you know, can you give us some more music like this? And I was going into my Sitting on Chrome album. Can you give us a record that caters to the car culture audience? And that's when I went in the studio and made this new album called Sitting on Chrome. And, you know, obviously we shot two videos. One. We shot INC Rod right on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles. Had the cats cruising with the low riders, all the Mexican cats. So that created even more of, oh, this is a West Coast thing because of where we shot the video. And that's kind of how that all took shape.
That was a dope record too, but I think it had the Isley Brothers sample on that, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
Those are my biggest radio records. In terms of commercial radio success, it wasn't until Born to Roll and INC Rod that I had an actual song in rotation. I hadn't had, up to that point, I had never had a song in regular radio rotation on a major station.
And so that was like shortly, well, I don't know about shortly, but a little bit after that, I think Master Ace Inc. disbanded, and then you were kind of out the picture as far as recording albums or full projects for a few years there. Were you just trying to take some time to step back because you had been in the game for like 10 years and you were just trying to focus on family, or were you just trying to find the right sound or something like that?
Well, a lot of things happened after that album came out. The first thing that happened was the perception of me on the East Coast back home was that I was this, you know, quote unquote, West Coast sellout. And that, you know, you got to remember, this is a time when it was East versus West.
Right.
And it was a very real thing. And so, you know, it was the sentiment back then was this us versus them. And here I come as an East Coast, Brooklyn born and raised cat doing records that are being loved by them. And so it was like, it became a, whose side are you on? You know what I mean? And so that sentiment happened. Then I got the opportunity to sign with a label back East, which, you know, I was kind of struggling with being labeled that way. Now I had this opportunity to sign with the label back East, and I took that opportunity. I went in the studio. I started recording new music that was more kind of true to the East Coast or true to kind of who I grew up being. But at the same time, this is the beginning of, or the height, I should say, of the Puff Daddy Bad Boy era, where now the music has changed into this kind of R&B driven, really shiny, glossy, danceable, almost disco feeling music. And that wasn't where I was at, you know, creatively. The label, after I delivered the first 10 or 12 songs, decided that it just wasn't in line with what was happening on the radio and decided to drop the project. So I had about 15 songs, and it got shelved. And so around that same time, I had Paula Perry, who was originally signed to A&M Records. She got dropped from Motown before she even came out. I had the Lachey project that got dropped. So I had like three projects that just immediately disappeared from existence. And I became really disenchanted with the industry and decided that I didn't want to make records anymore. I decided that I was going to go behind the scenes and just be a producer, because I produced a lot of those radio records, the Born to Roll, INC Rod, Sitting on Chrome. I produced all those records. So I said, well, maybe I should just go behind the scenes and produce and focus on production. And that's what I did for about 4 years straight. I was just a behind the scenes dude, trying to get my production, you know, game up. And that's what was happening during all of that time.
It's funny that you mentioned that you felt kind of disenchanted at that moment. I want to read something to you real quick. This is something that I kind of came across here. Let's see. So it says, truthfully, I'm glad some rap fans remember me. I read all the letters and emails you're sending me. Honestly, the game don't feel like a friend to me. It feels more like I'm sleeping with the enemy. Cause paying dues really feels like a penalty. The shit feels like a big waste of energy. Because cruel is what the rap game has been to me. That's why I'm about to get out. It's like 10-3. You wrote that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was on. That was.
I wrote that during that time period.
Yeah, I was gonna say that was on the record. I think it was Cahill and Fonte was on that record. Exactly. But you may have written that beforehand. Are you still feeling that way? Does any part of you wake up in the morning and do you still feel like that at all? Because I mean, obviously you're still in the game. You're still recording.
Nah, I was in a real dark place there. I was like just really angry at the game, angry at the way. I was angry at the way that it was appearing that I was gonna go out of the game. I felt like I was gonna be just kind of this West Coast sellout that didn't rep East Coast and, you know, didn't sell a lot of records and get out of here. And so those were the terms that I was going to be leaving the game on. And so that's why I wrote that. But, you know, the resurgence of my career happened in 2001 when I dropped my album Disposable Arts. And it was a chance for me to leave the game on my own terms. So I went in the studio. I no longer was trying to cater to a major label in terms of chasing what was on the radio, trying to be current in terms of how stuff sounded. I went in and I just made the exact record that I heard in my head that I wanted to make. I said all of the things lyrically that I wanted to say, and I put together this album that to this day has extended my career going on 15 years.
Absolutely. And I got to give you some credit too, because you have constantly reinventing yourself from the very beginning when you were experimenting with different ideas and you know, you had the Biz Markie record, the Me and the Biz and the Music Man, which was very different from Slaughterhouse, which is very different from your stuff that you made in the 2000s. But then on top of that, you've also branched into the international scene, and you've done records with artists from all over the world, like rappers from all over the world, countries that you probably wouldn't think that either knows about hip hop or respected the craft or nothing like that. And you've worked with people from everywhere. Was that a calculated move on your part? Because I know that a lot of times overseas, they have a greater appreciation for some of our older MCs than we do here in the States. And so I was wondering, was that something that you were deliberately trying to set up? So like, okay, I know that they have a different appreciation over there. Let me build up some credibility there and work with some artists overseas. And then when I tour, I can go over there and do numbers over there. Was that like a calculated decision, or did it just kind of happen that way?
No, if I said it was calculated, I'd be lying. I'd be trying to make myself sound too smart. But what I did know was that putting out as much good music with as many different types of artists as I could would help my overall catalog and help my overall fan base to grow. I knew that being on all of these different international records was going to be beneficial in some way. I couldn't see it right then and there, but I knew that at some point some of these records would help me. So I collaborated with so many different people. I did an interview like last year sometime, and the guy that interviewed me on the station, he said that he researched it and said that I collaborated with the most artists in terms of different countries. It's not something that I ever researched myself, but according to him, the numbers say that I've collaborated with artists in more countries than any other artist, which is kind of cool.
And of course, you're still collaborating with, you know, people here in the States. So the EMC record, the Tonight Show record, came out this year. As I understand, you're re-releasing one of your albums from the early 2000s, I believe. That was A Long Hot Summer. Is that right?
Yeah, 2004. It's actually it's been released on vinyl. That and Disposable Arts came out on vinyl with this German company called HHV. But the CD is coming out this October. It's going to be like the 04. So it'll be the 11th anniversary of Aloha Summer coming out. It's coming out on CD with this company called Below System. And they actually, I did a deal with them a couple of years ago. They already put out the Disposable Arts CD, but now they're putting out Aloha Summer. And I actually did two new bonus records that I threw on there just for people to, just for the bonus to say thanks to the fans and just some new music, some new flavor.
That's dope. And the Tonight Show project, EMC, Punchline was not on that project, is that right?
No, he wasn't on that record.
Okay. Now, what was the cause of his departure from the group? I know he left about a year ago, roughly, and I know that you said stuff like you guys weren't seeing eye to eye. Was it a money thing, or was it a creativity thing? What was the deal with that?
It was actually neither of those things. It wasn't a money thing, and it wasn't a creativity thing. It was more of a getting along thing.
That's important.
It's important. And he, you know, to his credit, he's his own man. He is how he is. You know, we all have personalities, and he kind of lives his life a certain way, and he's always been kind of a me first kind of guy. And when you're talking about a team concept, which is really what a group is, team concept, you know, if you're not looking at it as a team concept, and if your actions sort of show that I come before the team, then chances are that team is going to want to move you to another team, because It was just kind of screwing with the chemistry that we had, and you know, just if you're gonna be, you know, a selfish person, that's cool, but you got to be a solo artist. You can't be in a group and be selfish. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work.
And speaking to that end a little bit, there was obviously the issue with Master Ace Inc. when you guys, like I said, disbanded kind of in the mid-90s there. Lord Digga was recently on the Juan Epstein podcast, had some choice words about you personally. What was your reaction when you heard what he had to say about you on that podcast?
Nothing was revealed. Like, only thing that was revealed is that he's very angry and that he's very frustrated with where his life is. And that's what all of that comes down to. He was upset that on the same podcast a year before, I was asked the question, why did the INC disband?
Right.
And I basically told the truth, which was that he was the catalyst for the collapse of the INC. I explained why. And I don't know how much detail I went into in explaining it. I was trying to kind of keep it as politically correct as possible, but he just took, he didn't like the fact that I pointed the finger at him, even though that's where the finger was supposed to be pointed at. There was a point in the INC where we were going to do a record on him, and he wasn't signed as an artist, even though he said that in his interview that his contract was up. I never signed him. It was strictly on a, you're my boy, we're down together, I trust you. It's not, you know, we're gonna do this thing. And what he did was completely unbeknownst to me, he went out and got a deal on his own, which he had a right to do. And it wasn't at that point that I like was like, I'm not messing with you no more. It was not at that point. We actually went in the studio and started working on his album under this deal that, you know, that he went and got behind my back. See, we were working on a deal for him, and he decided that he didn't want to take that deal, and he went and did his own thing. But what he did, what he wasn't, was transparent. If he had just come out and said, you know, I'm not signing that deal because of XYZ, I'm going to do this instead, I would have had full respect. But the way he did it was really, really underhanded. But I still let that go, and we still went in the studio and worked. I produced like two or three records for him. I'm actually on a couple of the records that we made for his album after he did all of that. Where things got really hairy, and I don't know how much time you have to go into this, but where it got a little bit, where I hit the last straw was when I had Paula Perry. Once he did what he did with no contract, I said, well, anybody I'm moving forward with, I have to get a contract on. So I gave contracts to both Lachey and Paula Perry. He actually reached out behind my back and told both of them not to sign their deals, and that what they should do is sign with him instead. Those kinds of moves right there are never forgive kind of moves. And neither one of them listened to him. They signed their deals, and we got both of them deals. We got Paula Perry a deal with a label called Loose Cannon, and that record. That record was being worked on. We got Lachey a deal with Warner Brothers. Before we got Paula her deal, I had put out a song called Paula's Jam. I don't know if you're familiar with that record, but it was actually the record that sort of introduced her officially as a solo artist. I produced the record. I mixed the record. I pressed the record up myself with my money, and then I mailed the record out to DJs all over the country, probably 100 DJs. I went to the post office myself with the vinyl and mailed those records out myself. DJ's got the record, loved the record, was playing the record. All of a sudden, she has all of this buzz behind her, and then he slides in and tells her, "You should get out of that contract and come rock with me."
Okay.
She went and got a lawyer and attempted to get out of the contract because now she had this head of steam that I created, and that actually damaged me and her's relationship. I didn't rock with her anymore. The same way. We still worked on her album together, but it was like super cold. Like, you know, I was just coming to the sessions where she was recording vocals. I wasn't even like, you know, my boy Mr. C actually sort of took over as her A&R and started to help her finish the record because I didn't even want to even be in the studio with her. Like, it was like to that point. And it's all of this stuff comes down to just one word: disloyalty. As the person who kind of helps put you in a position where people are going to know who you are and give you a shot as an artist, that's not the person that you crap on. Like Marley Marl put me in a position to be known around the world, just to be known, period. He put me in that position. He's done things along the way that I didn't really like or care for, and, you know, little underhanded stuff. I might not have gotten paid what I was supposed to get paid here or there, but at the end of the day, without Marley doing what he did, nobody would know my name. And so for that reason, I never can be, you know, but so mad at him. I'm not actually mad at him at all now. Like, we saw each other. We were hanging out. He actually DJed for me at the Newark thing, which hadn't happened in many, many years, him spinning for me. That was pretty cool. But there has to be a sense of loyalty, and if that's not there, then that's going to always break up anything that's going to ever happen. And like I said, he didn't like the finger pointed at him when that's exactly where it was supposed to be pointed. He took his opportunity to go on that podcast, and all he really did was call me a bunch of names. Like, he didn't shed any light on anything. He just called me a bunch of names. It was actually pretty funny.
Well,
that's pretty much what I said about it.
Yeah. Well, nah, you went into great detail, and it wouldn't be in true. You know, it wouldn't be the preseason podcast of the year if we weren't running over on time. So we're not running over on time just yet. But just as far as on the hip hop segment, we're kind of coming up against it. There's a couple more things I want to get to real quick, and then we'll jump into the football thing. Give me your top five, dead or alive, real quick, if you could, please, because I'm curious to hear what you have to say on this, given the length of your career.
Okay. Top five. Wow, it's always tough. We're talking lyricists, we're talking artists, like there's a lot of different categories. We're just talking about rhyme skills.
Well, let's go rhyme skills. I think you're right, there are different ways you can gauge it, but let's go rhyme skills.
Okay, all right. This is in no particular order. I'm definitely going to say Jay-Z, Nas. I'm going to say Biggie, I'm going to say Eminem. And I'm gonna say Rakim.
Yes, you mentioned Eminem. He's one of the dudes that you influence. Like, he's gone on record on many occasions talking about how Master Ace has kind of helped influence the way he rhymes and everything. And I kind of don't feel like Eminem always gets enough credit. So I'm happy to hear that you threw him in there.
He deserves to be in there. He's the stuff that he did lyrically in his career is not stuff that you ever heard anybody do before. The wordplay, the way he put the way he sort of stitched words together, that was not something that you ever heard a rapper do before that. And that's why I put him up there. Like, each person that I named is somebody who, when they rapped, you said to yourself, I haven't heard that before. That's something different. There's definitely a few other people I could throw in a top five, you know, as well. You know, Big Daddy Kane should be mentioned. KRS-One should be mentioned. I mean, there's a bunch. I could probably, you ask me tomorrow, I might have a whole different five. You never know.
Well, as far as today's hip hop is concerned, like, could you see yourself working with somebody like a Future or a Fetty Wap or somebody like that, just to make something that's new and that's dope?
Not the people you mentioned. Nah, I mean, it's not. That's not something.
So not anybody.
I'm not interested in forcing a collaboration because they're popular. Like right. Anybody that I collaborate with, it has to make sense in terms of, oh, this person fits this record because it sounds like they should be on this record, and that's the only way I would collaborate with anybody, and that's it from any era. I'm working on my new record actually right now, it's coming out next year. It's called The Falling Season, and so far I've asked Cormega to be on the record. I've asked AG of Showbiz and AG to be on the record. I've reached out to the world famous Supreme Team. I'm trying to get them on this record that is like ideal and perfect for them. I'm not sure if it's going to happen, but I'm hoping that it does happen.
And we'll finish the hip hop part on this, because like I said, we're running up against it. But it's kind of a two part thing. But like, what is there anybody that you wish you would have had a chance to work with that you didn't get the chance to work with over the course of your career? And also, what do you feel like? Obviously, your career is not over yet, but just looking back on everything that you've accomplished, what do you feel like Master Ace's legacy is to hip hop right now?
Well, in terms of the person that didn't get to work with, that I want to, it's an easy answer. It's DJ Premier. Me and him have been friends for a really long time, since the beginning of Gangstar. Like, we worked out of the same studio when he was working on the first album with Guru. We were working out of the same studio called Firehouse in Brooklyn, and he actually did the scratches on my song Saturday Night Live. So that's how long we've known each other, and it's just crazy that I've never rhymed over one of his beats. I have a beat of his that I've been sitting on for about 2 years that I haven't done anything with yet, but that's something that it's going to happen at some point. We won't do an album or anything like that, but we'll definitely do a record together. And in terms of my legacy in the game, I just feel like what I've tried to do is be different, go against the grain, do records that were true and honest to who I was, entertain the fans by the albums that I put together, and hopefully I've, you know, touched some people, some fans, in a profound way with some of the records that I've done, like Beautiful and Brooklyn Masala, and, you know, just some of the records along the way. I've always tried to keep my lyricism up. I've always tried to put together lyrics that made you think, that evoke some sort of feeling, some sort of reaction out of you. And I continue to do that. I can't say what my legacy is. I kind of leave that up to the fans, the media, the rest of the world. It's not my place to say where I fit or how I fit. It's just my place to continue to create and make good music.
All right, man. Word up. We're going to switch gears and go into a little football. We got about 10 to 15 minutes left. And I apologize. This was not a scam on my part to eat up all your time talking about hip-hop and then try to get you on again to talk about sports or something. That's not the case. But
we can do that. We can do that, though.
Hey, man, look. I'm just going to put this out here right now. Master Ace, you have a free pass to come on the Hip-Hop Sports Report podcast at any time, man. Anytime the preseason podcast of the year is recording, you're welcome to come aboard and talk about whatever it is you need to get off your chest. And I got a hunch that right now you want to get off your chest some things about the Philadelphia Eagles, because as I understand it, that's your squad. Now, real quick, just to kind of double back, you played receiver in high school, as I understand it. You coach high school football, at least you did at one point. I don't know if you're still coaching right now. And you're a hardcore Eagles fan, so. What's wrong with the Eagles, man? Like the run game, like DeMarco Murray comes in, he gets like 11 yards in two games after leading the league in rushing, and now he's hurt. Sam Bradford's not playing up to par. Go ahead. I'm gonna let you go in.
Before I go into that specifically, I have to address something that was said about my football career on that Juan Epstein.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna say that.
No, heck no. Listen, I believe the statement was he was on the team. That giving the impression that I was like on the team, but I didn't play. I was
a 3-year starter.
I was a 3-year starter. I started as a sophomore on varsity playing receiver. So right. I just want to get that out there.
Nah, no problem. I feel you, man. I wouldn't want somebody trying to talk down my
That's the only thing he said in the whole interview that made me mad. Like, what? I was on the team? Wow. Okay. How dare you? Don't mess with my football.
Right.
But in terms of my Eagles, okay, I'm going to say this to Chip Kelly.
Oh, boy.
You came into our house. You said that you're the new chef. We had a full refrigerator and a full cupboard. You decided to throw all of those groceries in the garbage. You went in the refrigerator, you cleaned it out. You went in the cupboard, you cleaned it out. You said you're bringing in all new groceries to cook this meal. That was your choice. So far, this meal is not tasting so good. And I'm going to put it to you like this. If this meal comes out to be a bad meal, then you got to get fired as the chef, because you threw away perfectly good. We had steak in there. We had fish in there. We had all of these. The cupboard was full, and you threw it all in the garbage. So this meal better come together. I'm trying to figure out what happened to the offense in terms of, I remember the first year he came in coaching with the old groceries, there was all of these imaginative plays and formations. I just felt like we were doing a variety of interesting and confusing things to defenses and had success with it. I feel like things have kind of shrunk. The playbook has shrunk now. Like, I feel like I'm seeing the same formations, the same motions. I was so confused when Chip first came and the stuff that they were doing. They were lining up with like a swinging gate with a tackle went outside with the receivers. They were doing some crazy stuff. And then I just don't know what happened to all of that imagination. I don't know if his assistant coaches or the owners or somebody told him that you can't do all that stuff. I don't know if it's the quarterback. Maybe he's not, maybe Sam Bradford isn't grasping, you know, the full thickness of the playbook yet. I'm trying to figure it out, but the offense looks very stale. It looks like Sam Bradford doesn't know what he's looking at when he drops back, and I'm super concerned about where this offense is going and what it's looking like. I'm not happy with the run game because we led the league in rushing a couple years ago with a different back. I understand the offensive line is kind of new. You let some guys go. Again, more groceries thrown in the garbage. these are groceries that you said you want to cook your meal with. This meal better taste good, because right now I'm not the first bite of my food, I'm not liking it.
Well, it's like it's the old Bill Parcells analogy, where Bill Parcells came in the Dallas, I think it was at the time, or maybe it was New England. I think it was Dallas when he said it, but he said, you know, if you're gonna bring me in to cook the meal, you might as well let me shop for the groceries. In other words, you might as well let me pick the players that are going to be out here executing for me. And Chip Kelly has full autonomy over the Eagles front office right now. And like you said, they got rid of a lot of big name players, a lot of high profile names. He kind of 86'd them, and things have not gotten off to the start that a lot of people thought. The Eagles were a popular Super Bowl pick. I had them winning a division. I had them winning the NFC East. I didn't have them going to the Super Bowl, but they were a popular pick, and things have not gone well. But I got to ask you, Ace, do you buy into, on any level, do you buy into the angle that Chip Kelly is racist thing?
I don't buy that. I mean, I watched enough Oregon games when he was coaching in college and saw all of these terrific, you know, African American players running around scoring touchdowns like crazy. So, it's, you know, if you just look at his Oregon teams, it's pretty clear that he's not racist.
I agree.
He wants to win, and so he's going to go out and get the players that are going to help him win. So I don't believe in that. I do believe that part of the reason he may have gotten rid of a DeSean Jackson or Jeremy Maclin is because those guys had a certain amount of cachet with the franchise. The fans loved them. They were kind of already established in terms of who they were identity-wise. And he wants guys that develop their identity through him. And I think that had a lot to do with same thing with, you know, with Shady, you know, McCoy. I think all those guys had cachet in the city already, and they didn't get it from him. So he wanted to clean house and get guys that when they have success, it's going to be because of what he did as a coach and not what Andy Reid did or the previous regime did. I think that had a lot to do with it.
Yeah, so it sounded like more of an ego thing possibly than anything else.
Definitely an ego. Definitely an ego.
Let me ask you this. Who is the best quarterback in the NFL right now?
QB?
Yep.
It's Tom Brady. It's Aaron Rodgers. It's like a 1A, but it's Tom Brady. Until somebody can show me otherwise, I got to say it's Tom Brady.
Let me stop you right there right quick. That's what I'm talking about. Finally. I don't know how much you know about me personally, but I am a huge Tom Brady supporter. And I feel like he's still, as great as he is, he still a lot of times doesn't get the just due that he deserves. And I'm not going to say anything remotely negative about Aaron Rodgers. But I will say that even though Rodgers, to me, he throws a better deep ball, he's more mobile, he's more accurate, I think, even than Brady at this point. The mechanical things, Rodgers has it, but it's the intangible things that I think separates them. It's being down two touchdowns or down 10 points to Seattle, the best defense in the league in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, and leading your team back. I don't know if any other quarterback could have done that, including Aaron Rodgers, because he just had Seattle 2 weeks before that, and he came up small in that game. So it's those kind of things that I think separates Tom Brady from the rest of the pack.
What I love about Tom Brady, and I'm in no way a Patriots fan. Like I never really liked the Patriots, but I've come to respect them because of what they do, and how they do it. When I see Bill Belichick win a Super Bowl with a wide receiver playing corner,
yep,
I know that those guys have it figured out over there. What I respect about Tom Brady is. If you remember, there was a documentary called The Brady Six.
Yep.
It was a great documentary. It actually profiled the six quarterbacks that were picked before Tom Brady in that year's draft and where those guys are now. And I love the fact that he was the underdog with a chip on his shoulder that had nothing to prove, because in a lot of ways, I feel like that.
Yep.
I relate to him in those ways. He says every time out there, he remembers being sitting there waiting for his name to be called. He remembers his parents being halfway in tears that he wasn't going to possibly get picked at all. He remembers being called slow and, you know, all of those negative things. I relate to that directly in terms of my career. So that's why I respect him, and I love his killer instinct. I love the fact that every time he steps on the field, all he's thinking about is being that. Even after all the Super Bowls, he still has that chip on his shoulder. Like, y'all don't think I was good enough. And that's exactly, when I step into the studio, it's the exact same way.
Absolutely, man. And when I step into this podcast booth, you know what I'm saying? It's the exact same way. Well, you know what I'm saying. I mean, I do what I can on the podcast and on the website. But, nah, I feel you 100%. And you don't know this about me, but I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. So, you know, we're the underdog city. We're the underdog capital of the United States is Cleveland. Because everybody takes shots at Cleveland, whether we deserve it or not. We've just been picked on and kicked around forever, especially our sports team. So I definitely relate to that. And I wanted to ask you real quick before we get out of here. I don't know how into college football you are, but, you know, the kid from LSU, Leonard Fournette, is just running all over the country like he's mad at the grass. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
he had another 233 yards, I think, yesterday and three touchdowns. Now they're, you know, invoking the conversation again of should there be should they get rid of the 3-year and out rule kind of thing as far as the draft eligibility is concerned. Where do you shake out on that real quick with Fournette? Or just anybody for that matter, because I'm asking you as both a high school coach and somebody who cares about young people, and then also, you know, like I said, a former player and somebody who went to college himself and graduated. You know what I'm saying? You have all those experiences. So where do you come out on that? And you started your professional career before you graduated from college.
Yes. Well, I feel like after the sophomore year is kind of the right time to allow a kid to attempt to go into the league. I worry about some of the younger guys trying to come out early just because they haven't developed yet. And don't get me wrong, I know that money is so tempting. You're looking at it, it's right there. It's like the golden bucket at the end of the rainbow. You're tearing up college football. Everybody believes that you can step right in right now and, you know, be this incredible NFL player. And in some cases, you know, it's true. But in a lot of cases, these guys are not ready to go to the league, and they're looking at the money, and they're not looking at their futures in the right way. I hate to see a kid leave early because they don't realize they get to those training camps and they disappear. They really do disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think is underrated, and I like to think that most of the big schools or big colleges do this now, but many don't, is the insurance policies. Are you're aware that a player like a Fournette can buy an insurance policy for millions of dollars that insures him if he was to be injured, for example, during this season,
mm-hmm.
and not ever play because of that injury, he would be paid a huge windfall money.
Settlement, right.
Yeah, settlement because of the fact that because of that injury, if not for that injury, he would have made this amount of money in his NFL career. I think that more colleges should be pushing their star players and even some of their mid-level players to get these policies because, I mean, it's a matter of an ACL tear, one cut in the dirt, one little bad cut on the turf, and all of a sudden your entire football career can be over because a guy that's projected to be a top 10 pick tears an ACL, and then all of a sudden he's a third-round pick, and that's sad.
Right, right. The most famous example of that I can remember was Willis McGahee. He took out, I think, a policy for like at least $1 million right before the national championship game against Ohio State back in 2003. And then he got hurt in that game. And he still wound up being a first-round pick. But, you know, that insurance policy definitely came in handy for him, man.
It should have been more than $1 million.
Yeah, really. It probably was. I don't remember the exact figures on it because it was so long ago. But it probably was. We got to leave it there, unfortunately, man, because we're about out of time. And again, we'll be coming up on kickoff. I know the Eagles got the Redskins today. So hopefully, for your sake and for you coming on the podcast today, I'm officially an Eagles fan today. I'm rooting for the Eagles in addition to rooting for my Cleveland Browns. Thank you, Master Ace. I am humbled that you took time out to join the preseason podcast of the year, Hip Hop Sports Core Podcast, this morning. Hopefully we can do it again in the future. Open invitation. Anytime you, anybody else from the Juice Crew want to get on,
no doubt. We're gonna get Craig G on here.
Dude, let me know. You already know how to get a hold of me. Let me know if Craig G want to get on here. We got the NBA season coming up. If you want to talk about NBA, want to talk about my Cavaliers, you know what I'm saying, making a run at the NBA championship, let me know, man. We'll definitely get it popping. Like I said, almost 30 years in the rap game, man, and you took time out to stop by our podcast, so very much appreciate that, and we'll have to have you on again in the near future, man.
I appreciate it, Jay.
No doubt. Signing off, y'all, preseason podcast of the year. Hit us up, twitter.com/HHS Report, facebook.com/HHS Report. Let me know what you thought of the podcast. Hit up the website, hiphopsportsreport.com, and make sure you go get Natural Life by Kenneth Hicks out there at OpenlessMediaGroup.com and Amazon.com, also available for the Kindle, y'all. Thank you for joining us. We out of here. Peace. What your goals are, so keep on striving and gaining, maintaining, keep your brain intact. This is mental training for the minds that have given up. Others are living up. If you want a sip, then go get a cup, and we'll take a drink from the fountain of
love, success, so let's all climb the mountain together.